And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. It's fair to say that Peter Linebaugh is obsessed. His obsession is with things we all share or should share in common, and also with the process of that sharing, the activity of sharing, using, laboring, subsisting. Systems of privatization and of what is called enclosure are deeply inimical to this commons and commoning, and in many of Linebaugh's writings, he highlights the determined resistance of people to dispossession. Resistance of this kind has occurred more frequently and with more conviction and courage than most realize, as, for example, when the Luddites went about smashing machines in northern England 200 years ago. And if we dial it back to the early 1200s, yes, 8 centuries ago, we find, or Linebaugh finds for us, popular resistance that resulted in the creation of a singular and in many ways radical document, the Magna Carta. Peter Linebaugh is a social historian at the University of Toledo and the author of a new pamphlet called Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and an award-winning book called The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. When Linebaugh joined me in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking if Ned Ludd, from whom the Luddites drew and draw their inspiration, was a real person or a mythological one.
Mythological, C.S. Sometimes you will find people referring to an apprentice of the 1770s who broke a machine named Ned Ludd. Not the machine, but the apprentice, of course. But there's no historical accuracy to this that we know about. So Ned Ludd was a figure of an avatar of the English working class at first.
So people in northern England in the early 1800s, they take up hammers in the name of this mythological person to smash machines. What kind of machines?
Yeah, 3 machines. Steam engine powered a weaving machine in Lancashire. That's one. There was a cropping machine in the West Riding of Yorkshire, a shearing machine. And then in Nottinghamshire, the third point in the Luddite triangle, there was a framework knitting machine. These were the initial machines of the Luddites of 1811, 1812.
And what did they have against these machines?
Nothing personal, as it were. the artisans of the time were very close to their tools. They understood that tools mediated their own creativity with their craft. No, these machines were introduced for the sole purpose of increasing profit for the masters or the capitalists of English manufacturing. And those profits were obtained at the expense of working class communities, the families of artisans, the apprenticeship of artisans, the communities of artisans and the skills of artisans. These are what they wish to preserve, especially subsistence.
How many people were engaged in this smashing of machines back then?
Oh, I'm not sure anyone has done a quantification, and I'm not sure it's possible to do because it was a clandestine and surreptitious or secret form of opposition. It had to be. Trade unions were illegal. Assemblies of more than 15 people were illegal. It was very difficult to organize among those who were proletarians, the vast majority of people. But the Luddites were a minority within that class of hundreds. You know, it depended on the community. I think the main thing to remember about the Luddites is that while there might be a few burly, rebellious men who would smash a machine, they were protected by their village communities, and the authorities had no way of penetrating the bonds in these communities. So this would it wasn't a moral issue as we might think, but it was an issue of community and class solidarity. And this means there was no oral record. You know, the best that the authorities could do would be to send provocateurs, There was a notorious provocateur, Oliver. But the danger of the evidence of provocateurs, it's in their self-interest to have crimes occur.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the Luddites' actions were crimes. From their point of view, they were upholding an older customary economy.
Now, in your new pamphlet, Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and we'll talk about what Queen Mab is, who this person is, what the poem is a bit later, you link this tool breaking to the process of enclosure. Now, what is enclosure, and to what extent was it occurring back in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in the places where the Luddites lived?
Yeah, this is really fundamental. There are many types of enclosure, but when we refer to the English enclosure movement, its parliamentary form occurred really between 1760 and 1830. That is, at the time of the French, Haitian, American revolutions. And it put common land, it privatized the land of England. One of the great historians of enclosure, Jeanette Neeson, refers in a powerful phrase to the closing of England. She imagines England as being the land, and the land was shut off from the people by fences, by hedges, by ditches, by no trespassing signs, by even man traps, to prevent access to land which formerly had provided subsistence resources for commoners. So the enclosure movement is really a destruction of the commons. That's one form of enclosure, but at the same time, there were other types of enclosures. England was imprisoned. That is, new prisons were built. Barracks were set up for the army, which formerly had been billeted in inns and public houses. That is, it had been mixed with the population. There was mental types of enclosure, such as dictionaries and grammars and the correct way of speaking English. And there was widespread censorship of ideas. So we can take this notion of enclosure of the land and spread it even to the factories themselves, which were being erected in the early 19th century as a type of enclosure. Shipping was put behind huge walls so that ports came to look like fortifications in Liverpool and in London.
And what happened to the craftsman workshop under this system of enclosure, which encouraged the production of factories?
Well, the craftsman's workshop as a whole disappears, though for niche production, for luxury goods, it will remain. But on the whole, production of manufactured items ceases to be by the hand. It becomes the machine begins to take over, and skilled artisans became largely machine tenders or machine minders. And thus, the factory became the place of exploitation of the unskilled, of notoriously of children. Children, women in the textile, in the spinning factories, steam-powered machines looked after by women. So women and children suffered from the imperfections of these machines, the noxious gases, the noxious filaments from spinning.
What did the mechanization of labor have to do with expropriation from the commons? How do you tie this introduction of machines and larger machines to the enclosure movement?
Oh, C.S., that is really a very important question, a very fundamental question. And the relationship between enclosure and mechanization, yes, the two go hand in hand. Apart from the mechanization of the field with the steam-powered threshing machine, which was opposed in the Captain Swing riots, which were a Luddite form of destruction of machines in the 1830s, the relationship was indirect between mechanization and enclosure. They both had the effect of devaluing the working person, devaluing her labors, devaluing her skills. And they both also contributed to the growth of the urban proletariat and thus of the notorious slums of the disenfranchised early cities like Manchester or Leeds or parts of London.
That's the voice of Peter Linebaugh. He's a social historian who teaches at the University of Toledo. And he's got a new pamphlet out entitled Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, Machine Breaking, Romanticism, and the Several Commons of 1811-1812. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You mentioned earlier, Peter, the building of prisons. So what about the process of enclosure encouraged or promoted the building of jails?
Well, in a literal sense, the jail is an enclosure. You can't get out of it once you're stuck in it. You're sunk to do time. And this concept of doing time is an attempt to reform the soul, to use the language of prison reformers at the time. But it's actually a type of isolation and torture to destroy the ability to organize and to think clearly among prisoners. These great prisons were erected really from the 1790s right up through the 1830s. It was a massive prison building program all over the British Empire, also especially in England, in London, in Dartmoor. There is, as Michel Foucault termed it, a carceral archipelago in a marvelous expression. The Kilmainham Jail in Dublin. A famous place of rebels, revolutionaries, and malcontents was also built at this time. So your question was, what's the relationship between the prisons and the enclosure? The other main relationship between them is the criminalization of customary commoning. That is, people would use a land or use a forest as a place to derive subsistence by taking wood for particular purposes or by growing plants for particular purposes with neighbors, with others, and to self-manage this commoning. But when that land or resources are privatized, then those practices become criminalized. In other words, the person who sets up the hedge also hammers into the earth a no trespassing sign. And with that sign, if you're found trespassing or otherwise persisting in traditional practices of commoning, which now seem to be taking what doesn't belong to you. So that results in convictions of theft, which result in punishment, which during this period is transformed from hanging and other physical punishment, other punishments directly on the body, to forms of enclosure in prison construction. You know, just utterly abhorrent forms of treating human beings in such torturous isolation cells.
And the criminalization happened as well on the docks and on the ports. And you mentioned earlier sort of enclosure meant a rise in infrastructure around the ports, these large buildings. Can you talk a little bit about the people who worked and lived on the sea and to what degree that population might have drawn from, might have derived from people expropriated from the land and what their consciousness might have been?
That's a great question because the people on the sea are an international people. The working class in England comes from all over the world. You know, perhaps a fifth of the Royal Navy at this time of the Napoleonic Wars, perhaps a fifth of it was African American. 60% of the merchant marine was from the East Indies. That is, they'd be from Bengal or Malaya or from China. These would be skilled sailors who were picked up and forced on board under coercive circumstances in the ports of the British Empire in Bengal, India, or what's now Bangladesh, South Asia and East Asia. They'd come to London and other ports and be beached. That is, there would be no place for them to go, except into types of enclosures. You know, now that we're talking about that theme, like in 1811, there was thousands of beached Lascars who were confined in boarding houses that were little better than prisons.
And Lascars were from Bengal?
Yes, mm-hmm. They were. So what I'm trying to convey is that this is a terraquitous proletariat. That means it's both of the land and of the sea. And it's an international proletariat, which is divided by language, but quickly learns how to ask, do you have any food? Or can I share this with you? In other words, quickly develops an international language among themselves, known as Sabir, in the Mediterranean.
Peter Linebaugh joins us in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He's a professor of history at the University of Toledo. Let's talk about a poet named Percy Bysshe Shelley. He was born in 1792. He died in 1822, so he was, of course, alive during the Luddite risings in 1811, 1812 that you address in this new pamphlet. So Shelley figures prominently in your pamphlet. He wrote a poem, a long poem, called Queen Mab, which is part of the title of your pamphlet. Maybe before we get to Queen Mab, he at one point wrote a broadside called A Declaration of Rights. What did that document say that was of relevance to the Luddites?
Yeah, listen to this. It's 31 rights. He put them in a bottle and tossed them in the sea.
Really?
Yeah, then he put them in a hot air balloon and launched them into the atmosphere. These were the media of communication for Shelley. Anyway, 31 rights, and the right at the beginning is the rights of man are liberty and equal participation of the commonage of nature. So when I saw that word commonage, I thought right away, because this is 1811, at that same time, Ned Ludd, the general of the Army of Redressors, swore to put down all machinery hurtful to the commonality and repeal that to hang frame breakers. But we petition no more. That won't do. Fighting must. This is what Ned Ludd said. So Ludd is defending the commonality. Percy Bysshe Shelley, at the same time, is calling for an equal participation in the commonage of nature. And I think that this poetic and romantic expression of rights, on the one hand, on the other, the Luddites' reference to their communities and their commons, on the other hand, is a very powerful conjunction of human thought and human action at a time of world crisis. It points to roads not taken.
Meaning?
Meaning, people like Shelley are looking for, to them, equality is an economic matter. They don't refer to equality of opportunity. They refer to an equal participation in the commonage of nature. So they're English communists at this time, like Thomas Spence or Maurice Margaret, or there are others who believe that the land is made for all and who are opposing enclosures at the level of ideas, not just at the level of action or the level of customary preservation. They are thinking about this, and it's from this thought of Thomas Spence and Percy Bysshe Shelley to a lesser extent that English communism is renewed.
Queen Mab was Shelley's long poem published in 1813. What did Shelley inveigh against in this poem?
He inveighs against private property. He inveighs against authoritarianism. He inveighs against male chauvinism. He inveighs against meat eating. He inveighs against a monotheistic, cruel god. These are some of the subjects he inveighs against, which he does in the name of Queen Mab, the Irish deity or semi-deity who sends us our dreams. She's a warrior deity, and she's a deity of the earth. as Mercutio has a huge and beautiful speech in Romeo and Juliet describing Queen Mab. But this is the Shelley, like Hegel at the same time, was a strong believer in the action of spirit in world history. And for Shelley, Queen Mab was the way he expressed this.
So what does Shelley have against commodities and machines?
They dehumanize humans. May I read you from Queen Mab just briefly?
Please.
Let the axe strike at the root. The poison tree will fall. The war is the business of kings and priests who conceal their selfishness with free words. To Shelley, the machine encouraged slavishness. Like, listen to this. Power, like a desolating pestilence, pollutes whatever it touches. And obedience, bane of all genius, virtue, freedom, truth, makes slaves of men. And of the human frame, a mechanized automaton.
He alludes as well to the moral economy, which was disappearing. What rules of conduct governed that moral economy?
The rule of conduct there is that none should want while others profit. In the simplest terms, that's the main rule of the moral economy. In other words, there is to be no profiteering from buying and selling of food until the poor have had a chance to make their purchases. This goes back to the birth of capitalism in the 16th century and the legislation against engrossing, forestalling, and regrating. And these are all merchandising terms of ways to raise the price of goods so that the margin of profit can swell. The problem with this is that as the price rises, more and more of the poor, of the unwaged or the poorly waged, can no longer make purchases of survival.
Now, we've been talking about Luddism in England in the 19th century, in 1811, 1812, and the constellation of people and writers and seafarers at that time. Let's jump the Atlantic. A lot of people might not think Luddism was popular or was being acted upon in the U.S. at this time, but you argue differently.
I do. I think this is a really important theme. We think that the U.S. and Europe is separated, you know, by a huge ocean, and therefore the people must be separated. However, the people are united and are organized by capitalism in the first place. That is, the people who grew the cotton are the slaves on the plantations of the American South. The people who spun the cotton and who wove the cotton were the workers we've been discussing in England. But you see how the cotton itself unites them. Furthermore, the profiteering is united by the organization of this international trade. The same goes with sugar, by the way, and the history of the sugar plantation in South America and in the West Indies. So from the standpoint of these products, the people making and refining and manufacturing them are all in the same process. What I found is that whether we consider the independence movement in Venezuela of 1811 or the Hidalgo Revolt of 1810-1811 in Mexico, or the largest slave revolt in American history up to that time in Louisiana in 1811, an element in all of them was the destruction of the tools of oppression. Again, I want to emphasize that the tools that workers respect tools, perhaps more than anyone else, because they're extensions of their own hands, of their own bodies. Mm. But when those tools are separate from them and are used for the purpose of making them work longer or for the purpose of intensifying their labor or of dividing their labor from others, such as their children, apprentices, or their families, then it's quite reasonable to expect, and indeed we find, destruction of those tools. We find it among the Llaneros of Venezuela. We find it among the Aztec of the communal property holders of Mexico. We find it among the Creek and Choctaw Indians of the American South. And we find it among the slaves of Virginia, whose plows were redesigned by northern manufacturers to be unbreakable. And there was a different plow designed for the slave than for the so-called free pioneer, the slaves being much heavier, much more cumbersome. And then in the Louisiana Revolt of 1811, tools also were used as not only to be destroyed, but they might be transformed to be used as weapons in the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So I found really with the Luddites in 1811, 1812 is a transatlantic and also Mediterranean struggle against exploitation. And one of the means of that struggle was the destruction of tools.
Peter Linebaugh is an historian who teaches at the University of Toledo. We will take a short break and speak more with Peter Linebaugh. I want to ask him about Magna Carta and its meaning and impact.